Welcome to the Mama Bear Dares podcast. I'm Leslie.
I'm Tessie.
And we are sisters-in-law. We started this podcast because we wanted to add to the conversation that other female podcasters and writers and essayists and people with a platform were already having, but we wanted to add our own little twist. We knew that when we got together, we liked to kind of deep dive into the subjects that were really brimming in our hearts and in our minds. We would find that we would sit together and have these conversations about the ways in which we were living our lives as women and as moms, and just offer support and a place of community for one another. We knew that our friends were craving this too. So we're trying to make this a space where you can come, listen in, learn from our guests, just like we are doing each week, and just feel good about the way that you're living your life as a woman and probably a mom.
Yeah, absolutely.
Today we're dropping into our conversation with Christina Serrana. Though many of you may not immediately recognize her name, we believe that she, just like you, deserves to be known. Not only is Christina a wife, a mom, a pregnant woman, a marketing maven, and an unbelievably stylish woman, she also knows a thing or two about failure and disappointment.
Yeah, she really does. Leslie, even though this conversation on the surface is about failure and what happens when what many of us believe is one of the worst things that can happen, meaning we fail, right? It's actually about what it teaches us. Like, this conversation is really about what Christina has learned through that. So it's, you know, it's a topic that we knew we wanted to pursue early on because it's not about whether we fail or how we fail. It's about how we weather that disappointment in a way that shows our kids how to do it as well. And honestly, it's about not being afraid to fail in the first place.
Oh, you are so right. It is certainly about all of those things. We also cover what it's like for her to grow up and come into motherhood without a strong, solid example from her own mom. What growing up in chaos mixed with mental illness can do to the little babes who grow up into adults, it's a big one, and we cover it here on this podcast.
I know. I am just so thankful for the courage Christina showed by agreeing to this interview and really just the vulnerability she continued throughout our entire conversation, which got a little long, but it could have been at least another couple hours, in my opinion. We just, yeah, I think because she dared get it. She dared to do that, to be so vulnerable the whole time. So many of our listeners will be inspired by this conversation too, or at the very least recognize kind of the Me Too factor in what Christina knows about life.
Absolutely. Love the dare.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
And I totally agree with you. For those who have watched her move through the world from a distance for any amount of time, this conversation will really just confirm what we've always seen and known about Christina. She's complicated. She's fierce. She's funny. She's loving. And she knows how to use her mama bear to overcome really any setback. So let's take a listen.
Christina Serrana has done it all in her rather young life. She's been a blogger and a photographer. She's been through the process of adoption as well as infertility. She's been married, divorced, and then remarried. She's opened a business and shut its doors. But today we talk to this marketing and events maven, now pregnant with twins, because more than possibly anyone we've known, she continues to recreate herself and rise above any perceived failure to be stronger and better. And we believe she has so much to teach us and you, the Mama Bear listeners. So Christina, welcome to the Mama Bear Dares podcast.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I mean, hearing you go through the list of sort of nine lives, I realized that yes, that's a lot in a very short amount of time.
For anyone who knows you or watches you move through your life from a distance, kindness seems to always be there. You seem to just kind of radiate that, right? So tell us a little bit about how and where you grew up and maybe just how it shaped who you are now.
Well, thank you for that. That's an incredible compliment. You know, I think obviously our parents have the largest impact in our early childhood and sort of what shapes our personality and that sort of early childhood development. And for me, I was born into pretty severe chaos from really birth. My mother suffers from really severe mental illness. She has schizoaffective disorder. And so what that means is, you know, it's bipolar disorder coupled with some qualities of schizophrenia. And so because of that, my mom was really in and out of the hospital, really from my very first memory. And so the experience of, you know, having a mother who really suffered with such severe mental illness, obviously, aside from just being really traumatizing on my attachment, which I know we'll talk about later, but it was also this sort of extreme blessing for me in my life and who I have become, in the sense that instilled this incredible capacity to have immense amount of compassion for other human beings. And I think, and I found this to be a quality of a lot of people who have had trauma in their young life, that when you grow up having worry or any amount of sort of painful circumstances, it really allows you to get outside of yourself from a very young age. And I think it planted the seed inside me to really be able to recognize pain in others and to really, from a very young age, want to try to minimize pain in others. And so kindness, you know, or love, or, you know, sort of reaching across the table and wanting to minimize that pain, I think really stems from that sort of bad place. It's the good, it's a silver lining of, you know, maybe less than perfect circumstances.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a second, if you don't mind, because you actually just wrote a remarkable piece about your mom's mental health or illness, rather. And we'll link to it in the show notes if you're okay with it. But it just was this beautiful, well-written piece about, you know, just what that looks like, how, what it's done to you to have to kind of take care of your mom for your whole life. And, you know, on this podcast, I think it's one of the ways that we haven't gone there yet. Just what do you do when, how do you be a better mom when you don't necessarily have the best example? And you came to some really hard conclusions lately. Do you want to just talk about that a little?
Sure. I think, you know, I was, and I've written about this before, I think when I made the decision, you know, to become an adoptive parent, at that point, being so young, I still really hadn't recognized my brokenness. And really, when I think back to being so young and adopting Hamtamu, who we call Hobby, you know, a lot of that was very reactionary, coming out of, you know, my own yearning to be a mother. And so from a very young age, the concept of, you know, orphans or children longing for families, or kids, you know, really wanting to have a mother figure in their life and not having that was just something that would just, you know, send me into a bucket of tears. And so I think, you know, it's interesting in that I had a desire to adopt before I had a desire to really be a mother. And they came from sort of, as bad as that is and sort of shameful as that is for me to say now, knowing what I know, because essentially really adoption only ended up really turning me into not much, you know, I was just like being a mother, you know, it wasn't.
Right.
I think at the time I thought I was, you know, I had a lot of that rescue culture, I think, that people have in sort of thinking I'm going to come in and I'm going to, you know, give this child a home. And it came from a desire to give rather than a desire to parent, which I know is a different thing than, you know, I struggled with infertility later. And I know it's sort of this different than this biological yearning. But, you know, so for me, it's interesting that with, you know, the two adoptions that essentially that I've made in my life, and I know we're going to talk about that later, parenting children with disrupted attachments was really intuitive for me. And so I really parented them and healed myself through the process. And so it was the pressure that I put on myself, the way that I sort of navigated that, I didn't have this sense of I need to be this perfect mother and I need to, you know, be so different and how am I as a mother? It was really, I need to just give this child the kind of love that I wish that I would have had. Mm-hmm. And it was really the exploration when I started to realize that attachment was a much bigger issue and a much deeper, complex phenomenon than I had really given a lot of thought to walking into it, that I started to really study attachments and trauma. And when I started to study attachment and trauma, that was really the beginning of my own journey to healing. Mm-hmm. And so I sort of walked side by side with these two children, you know, to heal myself while, you know, they were healing. And I think in terms of the pregnancy, that's been a little different journey for me in the sense that it awoke a very different concern about biological, you know, disease in my family. And for me, there, it was a different kind of pressure that I had felt the minute I got pregnant. It felt to me much more frightening. And I know that might sound backwards to someone, but for me, parenting Haptamu never really scared me. It just, like I said, it just felt, I felt so much like him. And I assimilated so easily with him and with Julie, where with these, you know, twins that I'm sort of, that are being brought to life inside of me, that has been a very different experience where, you know, they haven't gone through pain and they haven't gone through trauma and they, you know, they're still protected from anyone hurting them or any bad thing happening. And so there feels almost this higher level of pressure to not do that. And for me, that's been sort of this crazy journey of really looking at my relationship with my mother and, you know, feeling this enormous amount of pressure to, instead of not be the healer, not be the person who, you know, somehow creates trauma in my children and really recognizing what I had gone through as a child, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, it definitely does. And Christine, I'm curious just to hear, you know, a very articulate, intelligent woman, you kind of learned as you were parenting with Hobby. And now how are you doing that in this process of pregnancy? Like, who are the people that you're looking to for help as you process this? Or I know you're a reader, you know, noticed you just stayed up all night, I think, reading Glennon's new book, which we'll get to later. But what resources are you kind of taking advantage of? You've recognized that you need to. So what steps are you kind of taking during this pregnancy?
Yeah, well, so what's interesting is that I longed to be pregnant for so long, and I've done a lot of therapy, and I went through a really pretty intense infertility struggle to get pregnant. And so when I became pregnant, I had a mourning and a loss for my mother that I didn't expect, that I went through. I had grief. And, you know, I know a lot of people have had postpartum, you know, adoption. I know people have gone through sort of loss of what they thought the adoption was going to be. And after the experience, that was not my experience. And I don't want to minimize that or sugarcoat. I mean, I think for us, the, you know, our attachment and our experience of being adoptive parents was fairly uncomplicated in the sense that we didn't really have, not to say it was super easy or that there, we didn't do a lot of work and we don't continue to work, but the grief that I experienced when I became pregnant, and the loss of really feeling, I think I felt, and I think when you look around, you see, you know, adopting an older child, my first adoption, my son was 2.5. And I think that you need less, not less, but for me, being pregnant and then a newborn, I think is really a very intimate time between mothers and daughters. When I look around at my friends, the experience of pregnancy and the experience of having a newborn, they're very close to their mothers at that time. Mm-hmm. And usually their mother, you know, if you look at tribes across the world, it's that sort of 2-year process of pregnancy, childbirth, and then postpartum rearing, mm-hmm. where you really have this sort of family unit. And probably like 4 months into my pregnancy, I started having, I guess, you know, symptoms of depression, just crying and grief. And I had a longing for my mom that I hadn't felt in a really long time. And I think that catapulted me into putting a lot of time and energy, again, sort of reinvigorating my need to really push myself in the relationship to try to fix her. Mm-hmm. And so the past, you know, I guess 4 or 5 months has really been a journey of, one, accepting that, you know, as much as I thought I'd be glowing and pregnant and having this sort of euphoric experience, I think it's okay. You know, it was admitting I'm feeling unhappiness and I'm sad and I don't know why. Mm-hmm. And then two, it was really reaching out to the other women in my life and saying, you know, what is this feeling? Like, what is this experience of being sad? And there's a couple resources. I had read a book called Motherless Daughters, and the same author also has written a book called Motherless Mothers. Mm-hmm. And this is fairly common for mothers who have either lost a mother due to death or to illness to grieve during pregnancy and when their children are born. And so for me, that's been my journey. And I think really just talking to people about it. And it was amazing to me when I opened up and said, you know, I'm having this grief pregnant. How many people said, you know, my husband had an affair pregnant and I had to be put on medication, or I had really bad in utero depression, or I've had, you know, when the babies came, it opened up a big discussion with my friendship tribe around postpartum. And I think, you know, just openness, just being willing to accept that what you feel is what you feel, and really leaning into whatever pain that you have and not being afraid to face it.
Oh, that is so powerful. I feel like when we hide the things we're going through like that, then it just gives them so much more power, right? But you said like opening up was part of the healing process. And it is, it's that thing where people are saying, yeah, oh, me too. I've mm-hmm. dealt with something similar. And I feel like for me, in the, you know, when I hear someone say me too, I'm going through that, or I've been through that, then it's a matter of, okay, this isn't abnormal. There's right. gotta be a way to walk through this then. So let me figure out how to walk through this. And it gives you power over it rather than, you know, how it has power over you in the silence.
Oh, 100%. And I think the, you know, it's taken me, I know we're kind of skipping around here, but you know that, I know right. we talked about that Love Warrior book, but essentially that book, and it really started with Brené Brown, and it really probably started 2 years ago for me. You know, I was afraid of hard feelings my whole life. And so I, you know, especially in my first marriage and, you know, my, in the adoption, I wanted the perfect Christmas card, and I, you know, I wanted this sort of picture perfect life, and I wanted things to be perfect. And if I had uncomfortable feelings, I ran from them for a long time because I was really sort of afraid that they would sweep me away and that I would end up like my mom. And it wasn't, I think Brené Brown is really the beginning of the journey in that book, Love Warrior. I mean, I think she just articulated it in a way that was so profound of when you finally, you know, she calls it staying on the mat. Mm-hmm. But when you finally have the courage to lean in, and that's really been my journey the past 3 years of leaning mm-hmm. in to the pain and saying, I'm feeling a crisis, I'm having anxiety, I can't breathe, or, you know, I'm having, you know, these emotions, what do they mean? And leaning into them and realizing that when you lean into them, they go, you'll deal with them, and then they yeah. actually go away. And then you'll end up coming out on the other side feeling so much stronger. And that took me, I mean, 32 years to start doing.
Right.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that a little bit, if you don't mind, Christina, because, you know, we've heard from some listeners who have asked us specifically to find someone who could maybe give them some encouragement about this big life change about going yep. through a divorce. And Glennon's book, as we've been referring to, it's called Love Warrior. And it's all about her marriage and how it imploded, what she learned from it. And I know, you know, at the time that she finished writing, she was still married, but she's just announced it. She and her husband has separated. Mm-hmm. So talk to our listeners and Tessie and I just about the process. And, you know, you're talking about leaning into the pain. Like, what does that look like when you're specifically going through a divorce?
Yeah, I think, I mean, if I'm being totally honest, I didn't. The circumstances surrounding her and her husband's struggle mirrored mine pretty closely. in the sense that I was still pretty broken in terms of as a person when I was 20 or 21 years old and I met my first husband. And I think we got into this very serious relationship and built a family before we ever really healed the trauma of our past. Mm-hmm. And I think what that book did verbalize in such a powerful way was how easy it is, you know, to not go there. And that's what we just talked about with those, you know, unhappy or painful feelings. And so I think for me, when my marriage imploded, and it imploded overnight really quickly, out of an infidelity crisis as well, I was still too young and immature at the time to understand that I was playing a part. I was equally as broken. And I think that's, you know, that's really the theme in the book, is that she stayed, and rather than pointing a finger at him and making herself the victim, you know, she really looked at how they could sort of both heal and have empathy for the ways that they were escaping hard feelings. And that was essentially my first marriage. And so when, you know, when I got divorced, I ran, you know, I did the opposite. So I immediately went back to school and I just ran away and I was in survival mode. And I don't, to be completely honest, I don't think I started doing the work to heal from my first marriage 100% until I was remarried, which is mm-hmm. ironic. But yeah, it wasn't until I was in my second marriage that I ended up really healing the wounds of my first.
Yeah. What you said there is pretty powerful too. And I don't think our culture does enough of recognizing that we bring all of our past trauma and our hurt to every single relationship, whether it's a partnership, meaning marriage, or, you know, just lifetime togetherness, or mm-hmm. friendships, or with your kids, you know, as you talked about before, mm-hmm. this all comes with us. So until you face it, until you turn around and look it in the eyes, it just follows you everywhere. Yeah. And you cannot escape it. And I think what you just said and what Glennon's book sums up really powerfully is like, hey, whether you choose to get divorced or whether you choose to stay is totally up to you two. Like, nobody has any business saying which is right for your relationship, right? But the reality is, the longer we all hide from our demons and from our past, the more it affects whatever we have. So on the surface, it can seem like you have a good relationship. And I'm sure, you know, for those of us watching you and your first husband, it certainly looked like that, but you don't really realize what's underneath, right? And you didn't either, because both mm-hmm. of you were hiding, like you said. So I think I hope our mama bears take from that, you know, like, it's super hard work to turn around and face whatever you've been hiding, but it's important work too.
Oh, 100%. And I think, you know, I think too, there's circumstances that play into that, you know, and I think, again, going back to people with trauma, I think a lot of times for me, when you're in survival mechanism, to be able to pause life, like, I always love the book Eat, Love, Pray, but like, who can take off their life, you know, for 4 months and go, you know, eat food in Italy and, you know, go hang with the shamans. And I think that healing work, you have to make space for it in your life. And I think that's an important facet of, you know, opening up. I think when I finally did make the decision to face everything, it really was because, I mean, part of it was because of timing and growing up and being exhausted of running and being tired of, you know, not really dealing with it. But part of it too was because I was in my marriage with someone, my second marriage now, with someone that really gave me the kind of like security and routine and structure and space and support to open up my life, to be able to go there and to fall apart.
Yeah. When we were talking about interviewing you, you know, we really, like we said in the opener, have just been so impressed with the way you continuously rebuild after various things have happened to you in your life. And one of the things I've actually talked to many of my friends and said something like, should anything happen to Zach or all of this marriage thing go south in some way? Like, I'm never getting married again. it's just hard, you know, it's hard to build that foundation. And I think it really does take a bigger person to do it all again, to get remarried, to kind of find that trust in someone. And I think you lending yourself and opening your heart to Craig is just another example of how you do that. And especially now hearing that, like, you really hadn't, in your words, healed from your first marriage. So what do you think it was? Was it Craig? Was it just like, what was it that made you feel like you were ready to take it on again?
Well, I think my initial draw to my husband was that he was so strong. You know, he's sort of this alpha male, Boston businessman, larger than life person. And I had never known anyone like that. And so that, you know, the attraction to him was that he was really safe because of that sort of unbending disposition. I know down the line that unbending disposition was not so attractive to me once we got into things. But like I said before, like I was just saying, I think that he created, you know, he's so routined and he's so structured that he really gave me, I think I was really looking for a soft place to fall. And he is far less broken than, you know, he does not have trauma in his past, and he did not come with a lot of issues or trauma or, you know, anything along those lines. He was a pretty well-adjusted person. So I would say that he took me on a lot more than I took him on. And I think in the beginning, there was a lot of him just wanting to sort of save me. And I think there's a dynamic of, you know, stuff that happens, you know, in relationships where that dynamic is there. And then once, what's interesting is that I was very wounded when I met him, and he was very much my knight in shining armor. And he gave me a space to really break down, and fall apart and be still and sit in it or sit on the mat and go to therapy in a way that I never had before and work on myself and travel and face a lot of my insecurities because he was so unwavering. I do think it's kind of funny because once I got there and once I sort of was empowered, then there was this new sort of power struggle to then be equals and then, you know, change the dynamic in our relationship to really be able to be in my new power that essentially he, it gave me the backbone to be able to achieve. And then it was, you know, we had to sort of reevaluate things. And, you know, I think the thing about second marriages, especially, but just marriage in general, that people don't talk about enough is that, you know, the whole process definitely wasn't pretty. And I think there were a lot of times that we both wanted to run. I think there were times he really wanted to run. There were times that I really wanted to run. I know that him having to stand by my side while I did a lot of that work was not easy for him. And I think when I look at my single friends, because I still have a lot of them from, you know, being a single mom for so many years, I think the thing that I really say is look for someone that has the courage to stay, you know, and look for someone that has the courage to really be in it with you and do the work. Now, with all that said, we're on the other side of that, you know, and there's an intimacy and a truth and a healing and an understanding that is so far beyond what I ever knew was possible. And I think that I wish I would have known that at a younger age.
Yeah, I think that's a really great quality to point out. And especially, you know, as we raise children too, to just kind of keep that long game in mind and just know that every relationship is a lot of hard work. And that staying power is just irreplaceable. I mean, the ability to sit next to someone in pain, the ability to weather those hard days and those challenges. I mean, that is, I think you're right, like one of the most, if not the most important quality.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%.
So Christina, at the time of your divorce to Joe, you were a mom already, but you were actually mothering your cousin, Julie, as well. So those of us who knew you through the adoption blog circuit were pleasantly surprised to see this new addition, but we weren't surprised to see that you said yes to something like this. So from the outside looking in, this seems to be another theme in your life, just your willingness to say yes. What did this particular yes look like for you?
So Sissy was actually Sissy is Julie, who is my cousin. And she too is just this incredibly resilient young woman. She suffered from a great deal of abuse and neglect, in her young childhood. And I, from the time she was very young, would pick her up, to stay with me on the weekends. And so I was 24 at the time that she moved in with me, and she was 10 years old. Wow. Which is pretty wild to think about it. But she, I mean, essentially she's just been a great source of strength for me in my life. She is this incredibly old soul and has been since she was a little girl. And I never formally adopted her. You know, our journey together is really interesting because, you know, her mother is still in and out of her life. And so essentially, I just really saw my role as being this sort of constant love and constant strength and positive force in her journey.
I just, those numbers, I guess I didn't ever put it together, but she was 10 and you were 24. I mean, yeah. that's just a little shocking because, you know, like what do 24-year-olds know? Nothing.
Right. What 24-year-old does that either?
Yeah. Like,
where did that come from? What is it that is in you that was like, yeah, this makes sense. This is what I want to do.
Yeah.
I don't know that I had a choice. Again, I would just probably say it was back to that empathy and that compassion. And there was a day that I went to take her back to her home and there was no air conditioning on and it was like 102 degrees. And I loved her and I just knew that she needed to be out of that situation. And so it might sound strange, but it wasn't really a question for me. We just went to go drop her off that day. And I said, get back in the car because the circumstances had gotten so bad. And, you know, then within a couple of weeks, I was sort of looking at middle schools and, you know, I was new in my marriage. We moved, you know, I came home just like I came home when I said I wanted to adopt from Ethiopia. And, you know, I was like, we need to move houses. We need to get to a school district that I can put her into school. And, you know, we just made it happen. I think sometimes it's just you trust that instinct or that love that guides you.
Yeah, I think that is actually, now that I really think about it, the beauty of being 24 too, is that, you know, I remember me at 24, I also was a mom and I just didn't know what I didn't know. And so you trust the instinct a little more and you don't think about some of the repercussions. And so I think it's a little easier to say yes to that. But having said that, you continue to be the mother figure for her through the teens. She's now in Denver and you two seem to have such an incredible relationship. So what advice can you give our listeners? I think I might be asking this for me, but I'll just say our listeners on parenting teens. Like, how do we get through it? What's happening so that I can visit my kids in Colorado at some point?
Yeah. I would say like really, again, it's what you just said. It's those sort of like gifts of being young or circumstances not being. I think that I put so much more pressure on myself now at 35 than I did at 24. And I think that my power in parenting her, and even now with Hobby 2 at 12, is that I really never thought of them as sort of this extension of myself or my will, or a person that was like responsible for shaping or creating them. You know, and I've thought about that a lot in my pregnancy journey about how we talk about like creating life versus, you know, the words, the language that we use around adoption of someone coming to you. And for me, I think because I always saw her as sort of her own person on this own journey, I really just worked to meet her where she was. And I think that that was sort of this weird gift of the circumstances that I can see myself doing other things with hobbies, because even Hobby was a little more or felt a little more, I felt more responsible for on some level. And so I think when older kids come to you, it gives you this idea of discovering your children in a way that makes them feel like you care to know who they are and what they want for their life. And I think that's pretty much the respect that teenagers are really craving. I don't think that that is to be confused with like trying to be a parent and not being a friend, especially because like from 11 to 14, and if you ask to see, I was extremely strict. You know, I think those years, as I've entered them, as I'm entering them now again with Hobby, you know, I think those years, your children really need you in a way that they never have. And I think because they, you know, Sissy moved in with me right at 10, I was so acutely aware that there I needed to pour all of this attention. And so I guess my final piece of advice would be like, hold teenagers really close. You know, keep them home, know where their friends are, you know, try to have people in your house, try to take an interest in who they are, even if it's so different than who you are. You know, don't project your wants or your desires or the things that you want for them onto them. You know, allow them to come to you and get to know them. And I think really just they need to really believe that you like them.
Yeah.
And I think that for me, that's both Sissy and Javi, you know, they were my best friends for a long time. And I just really loved discovering them and just liked them. And I think that that's really served me well, especially now that she's 21, you know, she's in college and for the trauma she's been through, I mean, could not have her head on straight, but I go out with her and I spend a ton of time with her and I feel like she can talk to me about anything and she comes to me about anything because I accept her for who she is.
That's fantastic. One thing that kind of I latched onto as you were talking, Christina, is just like in the Christian vernacular, people often say like, you know, your kids are just on loan from God and like you're trying to, they don't belong to you.
Right.
And I don't think I've really ever understood that until you just said, you know, you were able to look really at both of these children as what that says, I guess, is just as sort of they don't really belong to you in the sense that you need to pour, they need to totally take up your passions and be like mini me's kind of thing, but like they are their own people. And that sort of, I don't know, just that kind of position that you guys were in and that you are in of just being able to have that little bit of, and I wouldn't call it separation because obviously like they're still your heart and soul kind of thing, but it's a little bit like you're off the hook almost as a mother.
Yep.
In order to really fully realize that they are their own beautiful people.
Yeah. And I think that really helps. I mean, I think it really helps from you projecting your stuff onto them. And I think that it also keeps you from a lot of the mom guilt that I mm-hmm. think I see so many, especially as all my friends are now entering into motherhood in the past couple of years. You know, they take it on in this sort of all consuming way. Where it is such a part of who they are and sometimes defines who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, my experience has been different than that. Parenting is a huge part of who I am and being a mother is an enormous part of who I am, but it's certainly, I don't define them and they don't define me. I mean, we are separate. We are partners on this path. And I hope that I'm able to bring that same kind of positioning forward with the girls, you know, that mm-hmm. I'm giving birth to. I'm going to try to take that lesson from it and hold on to it for sure.
I think you will. I've talked before with my other friends who've adopted and said, you know, I had two biological kids before we adopted. And I think that the adoptions freed me from that because I mean, of course I'm human, so I feel guilty about certain things from time to time, but I'm not consumed by it. Because there is something liberating about recognizing whether your children come to you through birth or through adoption, that they are on their own path. They were put on this planet for very specific purposes. And none of those purposes are to make you look good or bad.
Correct.
None of that has anything to do with you. So you can, you know, kind of give them the lessons that you want them to learn and that you maybe wished you had learned when you were younger or whatever, but then you kind of got to stand back and watch them carve out space to create their own, you know, person, their own individual spirit. And I think you said that so well. And as someone who, you know, has way too many kids entering teenage years at the same time, like that was stupid. Somebody should have given me a heads up on that. But I realize that like the times that there's friction between my kids and me, it's when I'm being too close. I'm like, you know, really not acknowledging their own humanity when I'm really trying too hard to put my own stuff onto them. I see that, you know, when they're trying to put their foot down and be like, but this is me. I want you to see me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, oh, okay. This is why we're fighting. Cause you don't feel like I see you.
That's everything. And I think I think that really would be my advice to just new mothers in general. After you parent teens, I think you look back and I think sort of parenting in reverse, starting with a 10-year-old, then a 3-year-old and now newborns. I hope that that is the gift, is that you let go. And I think that anytime you let go of control or holding on to things, you parent from such a more powerful place. because there's no agenda. And I think children know if you have an agenda intuitively, like at a very young age. So yeah, I agree completely.
Yeah.
I mean,
and
you're crazy to have five teens. I mean, how are you doing it? I have one. I laugh and I'm like my sweet baby who used to go into kindergarten and say, this is my mommy. This is my mommy. Like I drop him off at school. He's like, oh, you're so annoying. So embarrassing. Leave me alone. And I'm like, don't you love your mommy? Like, are you happy I'm here? I'm here. Don't you want to hug me? And he's like, no, like you are mortifying. I don't even want to be around you. And I think that in these years, like, especially with, I look at my friends of young moms and I'm like, if I had made him so, like, if I was so defined by being his mother, really the pull away and his rejection of me in these years would be, I mean, it would break my heart.
Oh yeah.
You know, because you go from, I love my mommy, this is my mommy, to like, you ruin my life, you know, and you have to weather that storm and know that, you know, now Sissy's 21 and, you know, she constantly, I mean, calls me for everything and they come back. You know,
they come back.
That's really good. That is the gift for sure.
Yeah.
So, Christina, when we were brainstorming ideas about this podcast, we knew that one of the topics that we wanted to discuss was disappointment or failure, because it happens to everyone and yet no one wants to talk about it. So, over a year ago, you opened this incredible space in St. Louis called The Nest. It was a cafe that featured really nutritious, really beautiful food. It was, the whole aesthetic was just gorgeous and the premise was terrific. So tell us a bit about that idea and how it all started. And then tell us how it came to an end, because a year later you did close the doors. So what went into kind of that decision? And how did you feel through that whole, I mean, amazing process, really?
So The Nest was probably, it's definitely up there with one of the biggest challenges of my life. So The Nest was essentially me trying to create mothers for myself. I mean, looking back on it now, I realize what that's really what it was about.
Interesting.
Because I had been like a single mom for a long time when we originally sort of came up with the idea for The Nest. And I was dragging Hobby at the time to like all these business meetings. I was working full time because, you know, I was paying my bills. And I just kept saying like, there is just no place that meets the modern woman. And so the goal of The Nest, it was really supposed to be about women and about women being able to be connected to one another and have this community where they could really feel supported and belonging. You know, the things that I think mothers give to their children, you know, a place that you could really go and spend time, or if you had a bad day, you knew you could go there, you could take a yoga class, you could get a juice. And so an extension of that was that women are, you know, are mothers too. And so we had a drop-in childcare area, kids could take classes, and then play in the back. And so when I met my husband, I was lucky. I was very fortunate that he invested in my idea. And so we built The Nest for 1 year. And that was just a very all-consuming but empowering, like, you know, every girl's like, if I met, you know, Prince Charming and he said I could do what I wanted and he would, you know, help me get it off the ground, what would that be? And so The Nest was really that for me. It was that I was going to have all the things that I love, nutrition and healing and mind-body and community, and it was all going to be under one roof. And that was going to be my gift to the community, was to have this sort of safe and incredible space for women to basically do what your guys are doing. You know, pretty soon after opening its doors, unfortunately, I think the mission got lost fairly quickly. And there's a lot of business reasons, and that's a whole other discussion. But, you know, I think it really ended up being a place for children, more than a place for women. Over the course of the year that it was opened. So I was in my second year of just working like a dog, you know, 90 hours a week, getting there at 6, leaving at midnight, you know, waiting tables, scrubbing floors, you know, everything and anything that you could do to get the place off the ground. It was just hemorrhaging money for our family. And it was extremely stressful, you know, just like any failure is when you feel something slipping. And I think the business model essentially kept it from being able to be viable. And so the acceptance the acceptance that it wasn't going to work out was a horribly ugly thing as I white knuckled it and was like, you know, I'll never forget the day my husband came in and I was trying to reinvent the menu and we had been out of town and I was chopping food, you know, sort of manically thinking that I could make some dish that would make everybody come. And, you know, he walked in and was like, it's, you know, you have to let it go, babe. Like I just went through the numbers again this month and it's, you know, it's not working. And, you know, of course I fought him and screamed at him and made it his fault, like any good woman would. And, you know, told him that if we could just change the menu, it would be the raging success. And it was one of the hardest days of my life. And I would say that, you know, the day that I had to let it go and close the doors, and sort of the breakdown. And again, I'll reference Brené Brown and Rising Strong, of sort of the process of mourning the loss of a dream and coming to accept your failure was, you know, it wasn't very pretty, but it was definitely an incredible journey for me.
Yeah, I think we all mourn the loss a little bit. Like, I mean, again, you are in marketing and you do such a good job that I was dying to come from Iowa and Michigan to come to go there to St. Louis, you know, because it did, you had set it up. It sounded like such a beautiful place. But I was thinking, you know, when you did close its doors, about just how powerful that had to have been for Hobby and for Julie to see you fail. I think one of the things as parents, you know, we put on these masks and pretend like we know it all, like we never make mistakes, like we never fail. But really, I often think that just sets our kids up to have no guide, no idea how to handle it when it happens to them, because of course it's going to happen to them at some point. So how did you talk to them about the whole thing? You know, were you open about how you felt during the whole process, both opening it and closing it? Or do you wish you would have done something different?
Yeah, I think I was very open. And my husband, right after my failure, had like two back-to-back failures in some of his businesses. And so Hobby really got to see firsthand, you know, what happens when you have a lot financially, and then you go to, you know, having to not be able to do things. Mm-hmm. And he really got to see us have abundance and then have to go to being on a budget. And he saw, you know, both of us go from, you know, being in very powerful positions and feeling very empowered to, I think, both of us really having to dig deep inside of us to figure out how we were going to get through it. And we had millions of discussions about, it's about getting back up, you know, and it's about continuing to fight, and it's about trying your hardest. And you know, there was a lot of stress, I think, in the home. Your kids see that. You know, I think he definitely was abreast to, that was a very hard time for our marriage, for each other. That was also right. It coincided exactly with when I finally started facing my stuff. And I think that you just have to be open with your children and really teach them that the gift of what risk is. And so that was for us, the discussion. What is risk? Why did we make decisions to take the risks that we did? That risk can come with great reward. And he had seen some of the rewards of my husband's first risks, but it can also come with great loss. And I think just the courage to say, but we both are so proud that we took the risk, mm-hmm. you know? And I think inevitably he's now seen us both, you know, come back, but he walked through that. And so I think whether it's that your children seeing you fight in your marriage, or whether it's them seeing you fight to try over with, you know, a career thing, or whether it's them seeing you, you know, go through hard times, I think anytime you can sort of model for your children that things are hard, you don't run away, you don't give up, that you keep trying and that it can get better, that's an incredibly positive message.
Yeah. And I, you know, just from watching you on Facebook and learning a little bit about the nest and your, just your ideas and kind of your know-how to get things done, I feel like I'm really proud of you for doing something like that. And it didn't work out. You closed the business, but I mean, you handled it so gracefully, it seems like. And I feel like, I guess I'm curious, are you proud of yourself? Like, are you glad that all happened?
I am now. It took a long time. I would say from the doors closing, I mean, there was a lot of shame for me. Public shame, internal shame, financial. You know, people invested in me. I think money is a funny thing. People don't talk about it a lot, but I lost money for my husband, for my family, for my father. And so I think being able to deal with the shame, but yeah, now looking back, of course, I mean, I feel as though it gave me, I mean, incredible strength and knowledge, and I've grown and I've learned, and I feel so much more powerful now than I did before I did it. But you know, I think it's a journey. I mean, you don't wake up after you fail and feel better the next day. It takes time. Like, you're like, you handled it so gracefully. I'm like, you should have been here when I was there with the wine bottle. It wasn't graceful.
Well, I know. And you know, I think when you pour yourself into something so much, then it's hard to not become attached to the results. And Leslie and I were actually just having a text conversation about this because she just wrote a book and she got the physical book. When was that? Yes, a couple days ago. Anyway.
Two days ago.
Yeah, 2 days ago. And, you know, first picture, she's super excited. Oh my God, it's here. And then like 20 minutes later, she's like, oh God, it's all bad. This is going to be terrible. No one's going to let you know, because you go through that if you're really invested in something.
Yeah.
You go through that. Like, there's the highs and there's the lows. And it was just, we had this conversation about like, this is your baby. You did everything you could to make it what it is and to make it successful. And now you have to become detached of the results, because now it's not about you. You did what you could. You know, you worked really hard on this, and you'll work really hard to get it in the hands of people who need it. And for you, the nest, you know, to be a place for women to land, to have a soft place. Right. But, and then you kind of have to become detached, but it's incredibly hard when you've poured blood, sweat, tears, and dollars into it. Right. You know?
Yeah. You're like, who loves me? Nobody. Nobody loves me.
That's exactly what I was thinking. I'm like, everyone's going to hate me. Like, they're going to hate the book. They're going to hate me. But I think that's why, you know, I really wanted to ask you that. Like, are you glad you did it? Because like, tell me it's gonna be okay. Like, even when you kind of go to that worst case scenario, like, okay, so worst case scenario, I'm gonna open this business and then I'm gonna have to close its doors. Like, that's really the worst thing that could happen. And yet you've come out on the other side and you're still this incredible person. Right. Yeah. And so you've been able to weather this, but I think because people don't talk about failure, and they don't really even talk about being afraid to fail, mm-hmm. you know, people are much more inclined, it seems to me, to feel afraid to fail. And so then never try. But right. What you're saying is that, you know, you were afraid to fail, but you tried and then you failed and you lived to tell the story.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other thing is the gifts that came from it really serve me mm-hmm. today, you know? And so mm-hmm. the knowledge and the growth and what I learned, I could have never gotten without taking that. I mean, I know more about business. I mean, for writing a book, it'll be, you know, the lessons or the connections. I mean, the friendships, some of the friendships that are in my life, it takes a while to see the gifts, but the gifts were unbelievably abundant. And I can see them now that I would not have without that risk.
Yeah. So speaking of risks, soon after you close the doors of the nest, we find out, I guess it probably wasn't soon for you, but it felt soon for us, you know, watching on the outside, but you announce that you're pregnant with yeah. twins.
Yeah.
So, and you were pretty open about your IVF journey throughout as well. So I can't help but think, it maybe was through the learning process of everything you've talked about, but even with the nest specifically, that, yeah, I might fail. This might fail. You know, I might never become pregnant, but it'll be worth it regardless, because you kind of understand there'll be some lessons and some gifts at the end. So maybe just tell us what that was like.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think infertility is, again, just a huge lesson in repetitive failure, like just getting up over and over again after failing month and month. And my infertility journey was almost 3 years. You know, I laugh because I didn't adopt out of infertility. And I used to always say, my like little 25-year-old self, like, oh, we chose to adopt. Like, it was some real great badge of honor. You know, and then obviously God laughed and was like, ha 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 ha. And so I ended up with, you know, 3 years of just, you know, heart wrenching. We tried natural, we did IUIs, I had surgery, you know, I ate avocados, I stood on my head, I had acupuncture, I did the whole thing. You know, I'm sure you've talked about
what did you do to your head?
Yeah. I stood on my head, you know.
Oh, you stood on your head.
Yes. Okay.
Lots of headstands. Yep.
Like I tried everything. And I think that's complicated because I used to hate when people said, once you let go, it'll happen. Mm. And I used to want to like stab people's eyeballs out when they said that to me. But you know, inevitably it was an up and down roller coaster. And there were times I gave up. I took a year off. I think after my first IVF, situation had to get canceled again, after being on medications, I know that I got to a place that I was like, I can't keep doing this. And I traveled and I went to Paris by myself and I, started the job I'm doing now. But yeah, I think again, it's just that journey of getting back up on the horse and saying, I'll try again. And so the next time I tried was this last time. And sure enough, 2 girls, it's hard to believe.
Wow. It's amazing.
Just when you think you can't take anymore.
Oh, congratulations. We're so excited for you.
I've often wondered if failure is a muscle that we can train, you know, like more specifically, the ability to weather failure is a muscle that we can train. I know as an athlete, there comes a point where you have to get a little used to failure, like in the physical sense, when you're working out, you know, you want to go to failure, but also in the sense that there will be days when you're an athlete that just are not your days. You're going to lose, you know? And so I can't help but look at your life and at what we talked about and wonder if you are so strong now that you got through your most recent case of quote unquote, you know, failure, loss or whatever through this IVF. Like you are so strong. And I can't help but wonder if it's because you've been exercising your whole life. You know, you've been exercising this muscle. Do you think that's part of it? Like, how do you think these disappointments have shaped who you are from coming from the mom with a mental illness up until now?
Oh, absolutely. I think that like, even, you know, you referenced the blog post that I wrote yesterday. I mean, I was always afraid of hard things or sad things. And if you look at my first blog, that I wrote in my first marriage, it was, you know, sunshine and rainbows and lollipops and we're so great and we're so happy. And I think now I'm much more interested, and intrigued by people and things and discussions of why it's hard, you know, or what went wrong. And I think that I realize that I'm attracted to people's failures and I'm attracted to their struggles and I'm attracted to their challenges and I'm attracted to, you know, their depressions and their tears just as much as I'm attracted to their happiness and their wins and their successes, and that the pain is equally as beautiful as the happy. And so I think when you start navigating your life from that place, you know, the failure is just as important as the win. And you start to not only feel like you can muscle through it, you start to really feel like you invite it in to see what you're going to learn. And I think I think when you go through enough of them, you get to a place that you're like, this is not only not going to kill me, I'm so interested and challenged by what is going to come from it.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I completely agree. And I think the tide is turning. I think so many of us would rather read those truthful, authentic blog posts than the ones that really are fairly sugary, you know?
Right.
I know I for sure, I just think that resonates with us. We're attracted to people who have not only struggled and gone through hard things, but then are open about that in a really authentic way. It's interesting to me, Christina, that, you know, you seem to really understand human nature. You've worked really hard, obviously, on trying to understand yourself and probably, you know, as you're processing, like trying to understand your mom and other members of your family. And
those skills have not only, you know, made you a really good friend and a good daughter and a good mother, but it's also, I think, probably helped you professionally as well. You're in marketing, and so much of that is just understanding human nature, right? So tell us more about what you're doing now professionally, and how it all came about.
So I work now for an agency in Denver called Unbridled Solutions, and it is my dream job. I mean, for several reasons. It's really, really more or less because of the culture of the job that I'm working for. And I think I tried to create this place of belonging and truth and authenticity where I was allowed to be who I was in a really open and powerful way. And I failed at creating that myself, but I found it. And so the company that I work for and the people that I work with are just so incredible in terms of, you know, I just remember very early in meeting with the owner of the company and going through this sort of cultural exercise about who the company is and crying my eyes out because it was everything. It was literally everything that I wanted. That I had hoped, I guess, that the Nest would be. And so it's really, you know, he calls himself a manifester of destinies. And it's really a group of people, 100 people, that are following and chasing their dreams and their passions. And we call that our thrives at Unbridled. And essentially, we take on a ton of different types of projects because we have these emergent properties. And that's, again, a really long and complicated story. But essentially, we all get to sort of follow our bliss and choose what it is that we're really inspired and motivated by, and then charge down to sort of create opportunities and build experiences outside of that. And so for me, I am trying to do what I had hoped to do at the Nest, which was build connections, human face-to-face connections through experiences that are powerful enough to really change somebody's perspective. And so that's really what I'm up to these days, which has been absolutely incredible.
That sounds incredible. Yeah. Tell us share some of that wisdom with our listeners. So how, just in a couple of steps, even, I'm sure that would be simplifying things, but just for the sake of the podcast, how would you advise listeners to follow their bliss, or how, like, to find their thrives and then use them, you know, in the world? Do you have like a couple of bits of wisdom you could share?
So I think that, you know, my creative director of the agency I work for, his name's Tim, and we were in a creative meeting once, and he went through another session, like a self-awareness session. And he said, you know, it's really about going back to what is the problem you've been spending your entire life trying to solve. And I think that's really what it's about. So I think you start there and you ask, what's the problem that you've been trying to solve your whole life? And like, where do you feel most awake and alive? What fulfills you and makes you feel powerful and centered? And then try to build and create around that. And so for me, I love connection. You know, I've always wanted to feel belonging and connection. And I absolutely love new experiences. I mean, I am very bored with being stuck in a routine. One of my favorite things in life, and I think one of the gifts of life, is when it doesn't matter if it's running a marathon or sitting in front of the Eiffel Tower or going to a concert. I mean, I love live music, you know, and I went back to like, what are the things that, like, when I went and saw Rent the first time when I was in eighth grade,
preach.
Yes. Like, what are the things that really moved you and that you left and you felt like the world was full of possibilities? And so for me, they were these really incredible experiences. And so I wanted to be a part of making and creating those.
Oh, awesome. That's a big question.
Yeah.
I mean, really, like, what is the problem you've been fighting your whole life?
Yeah. But I think if you're awake, you know the answer already, you know? I mean, I think one of the reasons that Leslie and I, even though this podcast is a lot of work, but that we're having so much fun, is that she and I have spent many an hour like coming up with ways to create this exact thing, but we had it in different, like, not podcast, you know, but we've done different things because we love talking to women. We love learning things from other women. And so we've tried and failed at other ways of making this happen. And yet here we are. And so I think if our listeners are awake to themselves, they will see, oh, actually, I've been trying to solve this problem my whole life, you
right.
know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important to note, you've tried other like iterations of this. The Nest was another, you know, you've tried this in other avenues and it hasn't worked. So maybe, listeners, your first time trying to solve this problem, for lack of better phrase, is doesn't work. And that's fine. Keep trying, right?
Right. 100%. And eventually you'll know. I would say that eventually, if you're there, you'll just have this sense that it's where you belong and you'll know.
Absolutely. So you mentioned it a few times before, but we talk about it all the time on the podcast too, is just this idea of a soul tribe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this group of women who enrich your life and who push you to reach your fullest potential. They're probably the women who were like at the door of the Nest as many days as they possibly could, right? Just to support you. And I feel like you have created such an incredible group of women. Somehow you're all physically beautiful too, but I assume that's just like your internal joy seeping out. That's what I'm choosing to believe here. So tell us a little bit about them. Like, how'd you find them? What do they do for you?
Well, they're all so different. I mean, we laughed. I just had my baby shower and there were 40 of us. And it's really, you see the diversity and the dichotomy of who I am when you get the people that are in my life in one room. I mean, because you have like the glam squad, because like I'm such a girl and I love hair and makeup and nails. And then you've got like the hippie, like granola friends who like do yoga retreats with me. And then I have like my super powerful business mavens that like, you know, run their show and work all the time and get shit done. And then, you know, we've got my mama, single mom tribe who like was, you know, they're all like drinking a little too much and, you know, have been through a little too much, but have been like, we're there for each other no matter what. And we've, you know, it's just this incredible dichotomy. And I would say not one person has to fulfill every part of you.
Mm-hmm.
And again, just going back to that, I'm always just really curious about people. And just like you said, you know, you love learning and listening and hearing from women. And so I'm not into groups of friends. I'm not into like being around a bunch of people that are really alike me. I really love being around people that are really different than me. I grew up allowed to be different. You know, I try to raise a family where differences are embraced. And if you look at my friendships and my mom tribe, that's definitely, it's so evident. Because there's people in a room that would never, ever reach across the table and talk to each other. And I think that's, you know, I've always been a connector and I throw parties and I do a lot of connecting. And I think everyone always leaves feeling so empowered by the situation about really getting to connect with someone who's so far outside of their comfort zone or what they thought that they would find a connection with. And same thing as you. I mean, I love powerful women. My life would be nothing. You know, Sex and the City was my favorite from the time I was like, whatever age,
mm-hmm.
you know, that line in the movie, she said, I got to thinking the other day, where would I be had I never met you? And that, I mean, I remember sobbing and, but it's, that has been my life for me. And they're the women and they've changed. And there've been a lot of people I've had to let go. And there have been people that I've brought in and, it's an ever changing and evolving network and community for me, but I really could not have survived this life without them. And I think that if, especially everything we talked about today, I couldn't have done any of it without them. And I think a lot of times when we talk about postpartum depression or we talk about depression in general, or I look at my mom and her struggle, I really do think that the people that I've seen have the most torment and pain in their life really are because of a lack of community. And I can't reiterate enough how important it is to put yourself out there and to know that there's another mom or another woman that's dying to make a connection too, and to bridge those friendships because they will feed you, you know?
Absolutely. I agree 100%. They will save your life. It's so important. It's so important. So Christina, is part of what you do to nurture yourself, does that have a lot to do with your friends? We like to talk about the other self and the mother self on the podcast, and we always encourage one another to really look out for that other self. So does friendship play a role in nurturing just Christina, the part that's just for you, you know? Or what are some of the other things that you do in order to nurture that other self?
Well, I think one of the gifts that comes out of divorce is that you get to, you know, it's horrible to share your children half the time, but you end up with a lot of free time and time on your own. And I'm getting ready to lose that again, you know, because I'm having these, you know, with these two little girls coming. But I think for me, you know, I've been fortunate to be a mom and still be able to travel. And for me, like the ultimate nurturing of myself would be taking a trip alone. And I, like the minute I get on the plane and you're in a hotel by yourself, I mean, I went to Paris by myself. I traveled pretty extensively for work and you have this sort of night and it's this sort of rebellious feeling. I remember it after the day that I went through my divorce and it's, you know, you can stay up and it's like midnight and you can, you know, listen to music on the patio. And for me, it's that freedom of allowing myself to feel like I'm not just a mom or a wife or a businesswoman. Like I can take this night to be by myself with my music or my writing, and sit on this patio and drink this glass of wine or walk around the city completely by myself and feel the way I felt when I was young. Mm-hmm. And I had dreams and it was just me and my dreams. And I would say to really, I think a lot of women as they become mothers and wives have a lot of guilt over wanting to have their own moments to themselves, to want their own dreams. And I really give myself permission to have that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's powerful. Once you learn that, even if you slip and fall off the wagon a bit, neglect yourself for a little bit, once you really learn it, it's unlearnable. Like you realize that it sets you on fire.
Yeah.
You know, and that your kids benefit, your partner's benefit, your friends benefit. When you're on fire, like forget about it. You know?
I love what you just said because for me, I didn't do that, you know, in my first, I was 27 or 28 before I knew how to do that. And I think what you said, once you learn it, it's unlearnable. And I think for me, you know, a lot of me looking at when I got pregnant, I was going through that hard time. I was looking at my friends saying like, when was the last time you like spent 24 hours alone? And I was amazed how many people were like 4 years, 5 years, 3 years, 2 years. And I was putting this pressure on myself. Like, I'm going to have to give that up. Like, okay, I have to unlearn that. I need to not need that now. Like I'm going to have two babies and I need to not lean that. I, you know, I need to not need that. I need to be able to accept that, you know, I can't be on the road and I'm going to have to give all that up. And then I thought, no, I can't unneed that now. Now that I know what it's like to have that, I have to have it. And I think that, yeah, what you said, it's really poignant.
Well, this conversation has been so incredible. I really genuinely do not want it to end, but there's one segment that our listeners always want us to do. And we usually either forget or we just don't have time for, but I'm going to make it happen mostly because in every picture of you, I'm like, I wonder if I could just convince her to give me her closet. Like, can I get her closet?
I wonder where she got that. I wonder where she found that. I totally agree, Tessie. We have to make this segment happen.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's really selfish at this point, but listeners, I'm here for you. I'm going to pretend this is for you again. So Christina, we call it the obsess sesh. So give us three things that you're currently obsessed with.
Okay, three things. Well, I would say in terms of clothing, maternity and non-maternity, ASOS.com, A-S-O-S, is like where you'll find everything you could ever want. So that's like for a fashion find, that's a great one. I mean, I'm obsessed right now with there's alcohol-free wine that I just discovered 2 weeks ago, which would have made the past like 8 months so much easier. I mean, that and my pregnancy pillow, but those are sort of boring things. I'm trying to think about. I mean, I would say that I really miss being pregnant. I miss my spray tan. I think spray tan's like every Irish girl's like gift to life. It'll really like, I mean, you feel 10 pounds thinner, you feel 5 years younger.
Yes.
And it's really changed in the past 5 years. Like, don't be afraid to get a good spray tan.
Girl, yes, yes. Oh my gosh. So many people don't know this, but it is a secret. It's a really bad kept secret, but you guys, you got to find that.
Yeah.
It's so good.
It's so good. And I guess I'm trying to think the last thing, ASOS, the spray tan, And I think like on a really like night you want to go out, a good pair of fake eyelashes will do, will make you feel like a glamazon in 5 minutes.
Those okay. I've noticed you have them, and but yours look really natural. What kind do you use?
So I sometimes have extremes put on, and then sometimes I'll just go to like Walgreens or, I mean, I mix it up, but extremes probably my go-to.
Do you put your own on?
Both. So I have them put on for me and I put my own on.
Okay.
Yeah.
I feel like I actually just told a friend recently that's going to be my New Year's resolution for 2017 is to figure out how to put on fake eyelashes myself.
It takes 5 minutes once you learn how to do it and you immediately transform into feeling okay. Like you went from like a total hot mess to like so put together beach babe.
It's true. Like I've had them put on and I like the ones that look natural. But like, yeah, they just brighten your eyes. Leslie was born with these big, beautiful eyes, and I was born with my eyes half closed. So when I have those eyelashes, I just come to life. And so that is, that's my goal. So I'm so glad to hear you agree.
Christina, where can we find you online? I know our mama bears loved this conversation and are going to want to hear more from you. So where should they go?
ChristinaEclat.com. And it's ECLAT, ChristinaEclat.com.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, this has been such an amazing conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. You are just an inspiration. You're fantastic. And we really, really appreciate you, Christina.
Yeah. Well,
thank you so much. This has been so fun for me. And I am so excited to read your book. When does
that? Oh, boy.
Thank you. Yeah.
What a big, brave, courageous, amazing thing you're doing.
I know. Well, Christina, I'll send you one. I'll buy you one and I'm going to send it to you. I think I've already purchased like 16 pre-orders on Amazon. So I'll just send you one of those.
Just send me the link. I'll buy it myself. All in support. Trust me. I'm here to support.
Seriously, Christina, thank you so much. Mama Bears, failure. It is something we spend so much time and energy trying to avoid. The fear of it stops us from pursuing many of our passions because we are consumed with the idea that if it fails, it means we are failures, right? But Mama Bears, today we dare you to become bedmates with failure. As our conversation with Christina proves, failure is yet another thing that can happen to you but does not define you. If you get to the end of your life and can look back having never failed at something, then probably you haven't really tried at anything either. Failure is just part of the human experience. So today when we dare you to get comfortable with it, we are really daring you to use your ferocious mama bear that lurks inside to come back from the fall, to rebuild after a disappointment. And listener, we dare you to be open and vulnerable with these setbacks, with your family, your kids, and your friends. Be real with them about the nights when you hide in your room and watch crappy TV to recover, and then show them what it looks like to put one foot in front of the other to come out on the other side better and stronger than before. The truth is, once you realize that failing doesn't make you a failure, you'll be more willing to go for something that sets your heart on fire. And there is just simply nothing more beautiful than a woman who sets the world on fire with her passion. So let's do it. Dare to set the world on fire, and if the only thing that comes from it is a tiny pile of ashes, then recognize that little pile as further proof that you were alive and that you tried.
I love that. Oh, so good. Set the world on fire, ladies.
Yeah.
You know where to find us. We are on Facebook. We are on Instagram. We are on Twitter. We are on Snapchat occasionally. And we certainly have a website. It's www.mamabeardarespodcast.com. We will post, as always, our show notes to Christina's episode and all of the other episodes that we've done here on the podcast. You'll find links to Christina's obsessions and all sorts of other information. So check us out there. Also, we're still giving away a bundle of books. Mm-hmm. So we're coming down to the wire, though. So if you have not left a review on iTunes, please do that. Please do that soon. It'll take you a couple seconds. And it really, really helps us reach more women. That's why we're asking you to do this, is because we want to build our community. We want to find more women who are like Tessie and I and you, our listener. So leave us a review, help the podcast, and be entered to win a bundle of Mama Bear's Manifesto, which comes out October 11th.
Yeah. And you know what? Like, really, the bundle is a thank you. It's our thank you for helping spread the word. So, I mean, do you ever get a bundle of books just for writing a free review? No, you do not. This is it.
Only here on the Mama Bear Dares podcast. Here.
You're welcome, America and the world. Australia. We got a big contingency out of Australia. We see you, Australia.
And we'll send it to Australia. Yeah. That's how much we love you.
Exactly. So you guys definitely find us on the social media. I think this episode with Christina will resonate with so many of you. We want to hear from you. So meet us back there and then come back on Wednesday too.
That's right. Until then, have an amazing couple of days. Fail big if you need to.
Fail big. Do it.
Thank you.